Blog Talk Radio.
It's been a long, long getting from there to here. It's been a long time, but my time is finally, and I will see my dream come alive at last. I will touch the sky, and I'm not gonna hold.
Watson, and this is Until You Walk the Path, You Don't Know Where It Goes. I'm your host, Teresa Chase, and today we are going to be talking about helping veterans. And there are programs starting up that deal with PTSD and traumatic brain injury, but there's a lot more that needs to be done, and there's a lot more challenges. And creating a bridge from military to civilian life is so very necessary. My guest, Paul Anderson, is a writer and executive producer for Huts for Veterans, and he has one of those programs, Who is Making a Difference. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Teresa.
Could you tell my audience a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a product of the American Midwest. I grew up in suburban Chicago, and yet always gravitated to the mountains of the West. That's just a place that resonated with me on family vacations, camping trips, looking out the window of that Rambler station wagon, driving across the country, wondering, can you live in the West? And I realized that dream when I went to college in a town called Gunnison, Colorado, on the western slope near Crested Butte, a small ski resort. And that was in 1969, and I've been here ever since, really resonating with a place that gives my spirit and soul gratification and meaning.
Yeah. We were talking before the show. When I emotionally start coming off the spool, I go outside and, you know, the stress seems to drain away. And when you get rid of that, you can find solutions.
Right. Nature as a place for reaffirmation of life, for a perspective shift, to gain a sense of common ground, if you will, a sense of place. I think nature, and particularly wilderness where I live, is a really important part of that. I now live 25 miles from Aspen in the Elk Range of the Central Rockies. I live at 7,000 feet in a beautiful valley called the Frying Pan. And over the years I've been spending time in nature, I've understood and experience the healing powers of nature. And that's what I apply to the veterans who come to my program, Huts for Vets.
You are also an author, and you write about what you know best. And two of your books are High Road to Aspen and A Story of Snowmass, but there are others. Are they also wilderness-oriented?
A lot of them are. Historical is really my approach to most of the books I've written. And I'm a journalist by vocation. I write for the Aspen Times, and I was the editor of the Crested Butte newspaper before that. So I write a lot, and history and the exploration of the place I live is very important to me. It enriches my own appreciation and experience where I live. So I write histories. The High Road to Aspen is the story of High Mountain Pass, Independence Pass, which was really the birth canal, if you will, to Aspen. And back in the 1880s, the early 1880s, when Aspen was a booming silver mining town. The other story, the story of Snowmass, is about Snowmass Ski Area and the community that grew up there, beginning with homestead ranchers, again dating back to the 1880s, when our valley, the Roaring Fork, was at its beginning as a settlement in the American West. Former grounds of the Ute natives who summered here. They weren't full-time residents because the winters were too severe, but the mining economy ended up eclipsing the natives, and that's the story of the West. But so I write about that, but nature is a huge part of it, and the environment here.
What are some of your other books?
Well, I've written one collection of short stories, fiction short stories, called Moonlight Over Pearl. And those are stories that relate to me personally, about experiences I've had in the mountains, and it's my attempt to sort of translate my experiences to a literary approach. I've written a story about called Power in the Mountains, a book called Power in the Mountains. It's the story of Aspen's hydroelectric history, which dates back to 1885, when Aspen really led the way as in clean, renewable energy, way before it was a current trend for environmental reasons. Back then, it was necessity being the mother of invention. There was a power source needed to operate the mines, so hydroelectric power became that source. I've written a field guide about the area with flora and fauna. I've written a book called Aspen, Body, Mind, and Spirit, about the founding values of Aspen as a cultural center, and how the body, mind, and spirit need to be integrated for the nurturing of the whole person. So it's really a span of material and information.
And you also write screenplays, and you're an editor. So basically, you're a Renaissance man.
Well, I do a lot of things, and I found that living in a small community, first of all, to cobble together a livelihood requires a pretty broad reach. So, and I also have a lot of different interests. So, another thing I do, I guide in the summer for the Aspen Institute. I take all of their seminar groups into nature for an orientation that they otherwise wouldn't receive. And I give them also a tour of the community. So I introduce them to the culture, philosophy, history, and nature of Aspen. And that gives them a grounding into where they are, because I think it's incumbent upon local people to give visitors a taste and a sense for the place they're visiting.
Right.
I also lead community conversations at the local library where I live, a town called Basalt. And I choose members of the community who are interesting, and I bring them in. I interview them before an audience, and then I open it to a conversation with that audience and with my guest, and moderate that. I'm also doing a program that involves veterans. It's called War Stories, and I put together a book of readings about war literature, starting really with ancient literature from Homer, describing the Iliad, the Battle of Troy, and how Achilles flies into a battle rage. He describes PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, perhaps in the first literary reference to that ailment. So I have half the group is civilians in my conversation here, war stories. The other half is veterans, mostly from the Vietnam War. So we have over 20 people at the table discussing literature about war and trying to bridge that gap between civilians and veterans, which is so prevalent today.
Right.
And that's one reason that veterans are so challenged when they come out of the service. They're isolated often and have no qualified listeners to share their life experiences with, which are so demanding. And as a result, we have a suicide rate today among veterans of 23 per day, which is an absolutely startling statistic when you think of it. 23 veterans per day. It's a national scandal.
But from what I understand, that number is way low because it's only 21 states reporting, and it doesn't take factor in suicide by cop, drug overdose, car accident, enemy.
Right. Yeah.
And so some say that the number is closer to 200 a day.
Wow.
And that a lot of those are men who have been out of service for a long time. The non-vets and the World War II vets are getting to a stage in their life where they're starting to look back and take it in accounting. And there's no place they can go to get help to deal with what they're finding.
Right. The number of Vietnam veterans who've committed suicide, it's three times the number of names on the wall at the monument in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
Over 150,000 Vietnam veterans have committed suicide since that war.
Yeah.
And when I meet with my veterans and we talk, or the reading I've done, and I'm not a veteran, I should explain, I'm a veteran of the peace movement, if I'm a veteran of anything. I came of age during the Vietnam War, a very different climate from what it is today among veterans' issues. But I realized early on that I was not going to stop war, and nor will I see it end in my lifetime. So the best I can do is to offer solace and help to those who are deeply affected by war. And the effect that I discover a lot of these veterans have is what I would call soul wounds.
Yeah.
They have seen things and done things that have violated their deepest moral precepts, and they are wounded deeply inside. And they need the understanding of their communities, and they need a perspective that allows them to come to terms with that.
Yeah. I was in Borders two, three years ago, and a series of events had me talking with this elderly gentleman. And he was a survivor of the Battle of the Bulge. And his family didn't want to hear his stories, but he was starting to look back on his life. And he was remembering the good men that he killed, just because they happened to be on the other side. And his buddies who were killed that he couldn't save, and he had this tremendous amount of guilt. And so here he's talking in the Borders Cafe with this strange woman, and he was on the brink of tears, because he didn't know what to do with what he remembered and what he did and what he was unable to do.
Right. All wars have produced veteran populations that have struggled with their experiences, whether it was called Faint Heart, which is an early reference to PTSD, or battle fatigue, or shell shock. It's been throughout history that humanity has had to deal with the after effects of combat and war. So the price is high when we engage in violent activities as a culture and a society. And that's what a lot of veterans come to realize after the war, and particularly post 9/11 veterans, which is who we primarily take into our programs at Huts for Vets in Colorado. These veterans they come out of their service wondering, what did I exactly achieve there? What was my sacrifice really worth? And so they reevaluate that, and it's not an easy thing to do when you've given everything you've got to a military adventure, and then you realize that the results may be hollow and empty, and that then when you come back to civilian life, you're sort of discarded into the mainstream and expected to just reintegrate with no homecoming preparedness. That's a huge burden on these men and women, and it's not just men, it's women, and we take women out too in our programs, and the women are not only subject to PTSD, hypertension, and all the ails that come from combat and service, but they're subject to sexual intimidation, harassment, rape.
Yeah.
So there's a whole another overlay on the women population. And they're a very at-risk population as well.
From what I understand, the suicide rate and homeless rate among female vets is a little bit higher than men.
Wow. Well, it doesn't surprise me. It's a very tough road that all these veterans walk. And so Huts for Vets, this organization is new. We're young. I founded the organization in January of 2013. So we've been here in the Aspen area for a little over 2 years. The idea of the program is to bring veterans into the wilderness and offer healing opportunities in a quiet, peaceful, safe, serene, and beautiful setting. And we take our veterans up to the 10th Mountain Huts. There's a system of mountain huts around Aspen that were built and funded by soldiers, veterans of World War II who came out of the 10th Mountain Troops,
okay,
which saw some of the heaviest losses in World War II in the European theater. And these soldiers who trained in these mountains to fight in mountainous areas in Italy, they came back from World War II, I think, believing that veterans of future wars would need the same kind of solace and serenity that they found in the mountains themselves. So we have now a system of world-class, rural, rustic, small huts. We have over 20 huts in our area that are administered by the 10th Mountain Hut System. And you rent these huts, and they're primarily for winter use. People ski to them, but they're right on the edge of wilderness, and we use them in the summer only. That's when we take our groups out.
Okay.
And the 10th Mountain donates their huts to us, and we hike to them. The hut we hike to is called Margie's Hut. It's at 11,300 feet on a ridge overlooking an incredible expanse of mountain summits. It's literally 5 minutes from the Hunter Frying Pan Wilderness Area, 80,000 acres of public lands that all of us own. All of us,
right,
Americans own these lands. And that hut, and this is poetic justice, that hut was built by Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense, during the Vietnam War. He named that hut for his wife, Margie, who found her own solace and safety in nature during the tumult of their lives during the Vietnam era.
Mm-hmm. Native Americans, there are nations that when their warriors come home, they do cleansing and rituals to remove the blood of the past so that they can rejoin the tribe. And there, you know, during World War II, there were most of the military personnel sailed home, so they had a little bit of a bumper between,
that's right,
in service and, you know, expecting to be a civilian. But these days they barely get three hots and a cot, and you know, there is, they need that transition time.
You're right, Teresa. Veterans from World War I, World War II, of course, the reasons for those wars were pretty clear.
Yeah.
There was, World War I is not exactly clear. But World War II, to rid the world of Nazism and Imperial Japan, that was a noble war. That was the war from which the greatest generation emerged, and in part because they came home, believing that their service was of value to the whole world, and they came home with a sense of pride. But as you say, their transition to come back was much more gradual than it is today. They had train rides, transport ships, and they traveled with their peer group, which
right.
With whom they could share their stories. And then it was a much larger portion of the population that served during World War II. And you could come home and go to your local corner tavern and meet up with some of your service buddies or at least other veterans who could be qualified listeners for your own stories. Today, the number that serve is very small. It's about 0.5% of the U.S. population. And of that number, about 15% are combat vets. So, again, the isolation that occurs when veterans come home today is profound and really disturbing to a lot of veterans who feel alone, like they're the only ones who experienced what they feel. And not only does that push the suicide rate, but it attests to the 88% dropout rate veterans have at freshman year in college.
Yeah.
94% overall dropout before graduation. And it's in large part because their peer group, when they enter college as freshmen, are 18-year-old high school kids who have never had life experiences of leadership, of facing death, and the threats that veterans faced. So veterans are disenfranchised, and it's difficult for them to focus, especially if they have TBI, traumatic brain injury, which
right.
is a permanent disability. And veterans are challenged in college. So the whole return and the dynamic of this age of veterans is far different from any other veterans group.
I know your program is a little bit special because it's not civilians, you know, helping. It's veterans helping veterans.
Right. My board, Huts for Vets, we have 9 board members, and they are all veterans. I'm the only one who's a non-veteran, and that's a little bit odd, but I've been very welcomed into the veteran community because the need to integrate, again, veterans and civilians is important. So on our board, I represent that integration, but on my board, the veterans date back to the Korean War. Our psychologist, who's both on staff and the board, is Dr. Gerald Alpern, and Jerry is a veteran of the Korean War. He got his start as a psychologist, ministering to the needs of veterans from the Korean War, but the approaches he used back then he sees as barbaric today. Insulin shock, shock therapy, ice sheeting, where they actually wrapped veterans in ice-cold wet sheets to drive their body temperature so low that they would suffer hypothermia and lapse into a near coma. And same with insulin shock. They would induce them with insulin and shock their bodies and then revive them from both of these techniques with the hope that the jolt would somehow push them beyond this boundary of battle fatigue or PTSD, and of course it didn't. It was just...
It caused brain damage is what it did.
It was a torture. It was a horrific torture. And Dr. Alpern sees that today, so he engages with our veterans with cognitive tools with which they can apply to themselves and take home with them after our program so that they have something that they can work on their own when they're back. One of his approaches is how can these veterans become their best own therapist. I mean, he says, you know yourselves the best. You understand your maladies, your issues. You can be your best own therapist if you just approach it that way. He also teaches them how to reach for their higher selves when they come to a flashpoint of decision. And where a lot of soldiers, in fact, all soldiers are taught to react to flashpoints with aggression and violence in order to save themselves in battle, that doesn't work in civilian life.
No.
They need to pause and take a moment and reach for their higher selves to really gain a foothold on what they're approaching.
How do people qualify, or how are they eligible for your program?
We have a website. It's Huts for Vets, and that's just all one word, Huts for Vets at hutsforvets.org. We also have a Gmail email address, which is hutsforvets@gmail.com. And we have an application on our website. we had specified at the beginning of our program that we wanted only combat veterans because we feel that combat veterans are the highest risk. But defining combat veterans is something that we found there's been a little pushback from veterans who say that's a limitation. There are a lot of veterans who didn't technically serve in combat roles, but who still suffered the experiences of service. If they were on a forward operating base, an FOB, and they took mortar fire, indirect fire, or if they were in the medic corps and witnessed severe wounding and death, they all qualify. They are all at risk. So rather than just designate combat only, we want to take veterans who are at risk, who need a hand up, getting themselves together. And we don't typically have young veterans applying. A lot of young veterans in their 20s don't feel that they have an issue. They feel that they're okay, that they're doing all right. It's the veterans in their 30s, 40s, even early 50s who have hit a wall in their recovery, have hit a wall in their relationships. The VA is not doing for them what they need to have done. So they're looking for something that's a bit out of the box. And our program is that. It's unconventional. It's non-judgmental. We take veterans and don't judge them at all by what they've done. We take them because we believe in their humanity. And so we take them out into the woods with a curriculum of readings. And this is where we differ from a lot of veterans programs. It's more than a walk in the woods. We have a curriculum that I put together of readings that elicit through conversations about these readings, elicit deeper truths, philosophy, about nature, about themselves. We read Viktor Frankl about Auschwitz and what it was like to be a concentration camp survivor. And I'll tell you the parallels between entering a concentration camp and entering a combat zone, very similar. Your choice is taken away from you. You take what comes. We read philosophy by Henry Thoreau, Edward Abbey, Emerson. We read poetry. And it's not specifically about veterans or war, but it comes at it through the back door, and it primes the pump for veterans' own stories, which they desperately need to tell among their own. And so we normalize these groups, and they're able to be with their brothers and sisters in arms, and they're able to share their deepest hurts and their deepest truths.
You spiral in toward the core issues.
Exactly. We want to touch the whole person, body, mind, and spirit.
How can people reach you, and what do you need?
Yeah, go to our website, hutsforvets.org, or I'm going to give you my phone number, my personal home number, and I'm happy to receive calls because we want veterans. And by the way, this is at no cost to veterans. I've raised all the money, and my board has, for these veterans to come here on our nickel. They've already paid and shouldn't have to pay more. So we get them here by travel. We bring them here, and we run them through the program at no cost. Call me, 970-927-4018. Go to my website. Email me. My contact is on the website. But please get in touch and bring veterans to our program. We want participants from all over the country.
And you are looking for sponsors. Both
sponsorship
locally and nationally, who want to step up and help those who stood for us.
Right. We want to expand our programs, and we need funding to do that. So national sponsorship would be awesome, and it just shows more support in the broader American community for our veterans.
And you are a legal C3.
We're a 501c3 nonprofit. Any donation made to us is a tax-exempt donation.
Paul, thank you for what you're doing for you and your board are doing for the veterans. It's amazing.
They've done their service. Now it's our time to do our service, and that's how I see it. It's a debt to be repaid.
And that's our show. I will be calling you after the show, as I do with all guests. But I'm going to have John Parr sing us out with St. Elmo's Fire. I'll see everybody next time.
and go.